Welcome to Lecture 3 of the Your Five Faces of God series. This lecture is on fire. The organs of fire are the heart, small intestine, triple heater, and the pericardium. The emotions are joy and sadness, and the virtue is propriety. So this lecture is about the fire element, and as I mentioned in the intro, the emotion of the wood element is joy, sadness, which helps us develop propriety. Imbalances in joy can lead either to control issues or a sense of apathy and chaos. So in the lecture, I'll be going over the nature or role of fire, the nature of joy, and a little bit about why joy and sadness go together, because that always seems like a bit of a paradox. The virtue of propriety in more detail, and I'll talk more about the distortion of control as well as the distortion of apathy. And then I'll go through the fire officials just to understand how the energetic roles of the various organs play a role in our mind and in our propriety. So the fire officials are the heart, and the heart is the monarch or the emperor. So everything revolves really around the heart, and the heart is in charge of the whole body, mind, and the whole empire. The pericardium is often referred to as the ambassador or the envoy of the heart. And the small intestine is the chief advisor to the emperor. And then the triple heater is both the minister of the outer frontier or the outer gate and the official in charge of irrigation. So then I'll go into each one of those in more detail, the heart and what its functions are and how it is in charge of all of the other organs, as well as all the other fire officials serve the heart in some way. So when we go through the aspects of joy and propriety, then really we're talking about the heart's role in that, and the other organs or other officials are there to serve various functions in relationship to the heart and supporting the emperor. The pericardium, its primary functions are to protect the heart and to express the joy of the heart. And so, and it has to serve both of those and not just protect. It has to be able to actually serve the heart by expressing the joy of the heart. The small intestine's functions are mostly to assimilate useful knowledge and to advise and protect the heart. And so we'll go into that a little bit more as well as on all of these, some of the distortions that seem to originate more from an imbalance in that organ or that meridian. And then the triple heater, its functions are coming from the idea of coordinating the various activities of the body-mind, the activities in the upper part of the body, the middle part of the body, and the lower part of the body, and these are the three heaters. But in terms of this lecture, really, one of the functions of the triple heater is to regulate our boundaries with the world. And in that, it shares that role with the liver and gallbladder, with the wood element. So, and finally, we'll wrap up with some common beliefs around joy and sadness. So first, the nature of fire. Fire gives rise to the personality, or to the shen. Shen is a word that refers both to, in some ways, to the heart, but also to the actual personality, and these concepts aren't well distinguished in Chinese. Now, this shen, or this spirit, as this is sometimes called, this is the individual spark, or the individual spirit that inhabits the body, and essentially gives shine to our eyes. And so the concept of shen is best understood by looking at somebody's eyes. Somebody who has bright, sparkly eyes has a healthy shen. They are present. You can see the person's personality in their eyes, and they're engaged with the world, and they're happy to be here. So somebody whose shen or spirit or personality is disturbed has clouded eyes. They're troubled eyes. And somebody who's really not at all comfortable with being present has a flatness or a sense of vacancy in their eyes. And when we look at that, we really have the thought there's no body home. And so the shen then is really the sense of being a person. Now, the shen is said to enter the body when we receive a name. This is highly symbolic because by receiving a name, we receive an identity. We have been named separate to the universe, separate to the Tao, and separate from God. So then we lose our identification with the universe, and we instead identify with this individual personality or Shen. So then the rest of our life is then a journey of understanding who we are and who we are in relationship to the universe. Acquiring a personal identity is moving away from our true nature and original source. Now, this original source is called essence or jing in Chinese medicine, and it is stored in the water element. The journey of the fire element of the Shen is to have a unique expression of personality, a unique face of God, if you will, and yet be in touch with the wisdom and the source energy stored in the water element, and to express that out into the world with wisdom and insight and unique personality. And so it is actually a bit of a paradox, because the journey usually only provides brief glimpses of our oneness with the universe or God. Most of the time we feel like we lead truly independent, volitional existence. That is, we believe our actions are really separate from God's, separate from the universe. Well, when we believe that we're separate, this leads to the question, how should I behave? What is appropriate to this moment in time? And this is the nature of propriety, of being truly appropriate in each action. The irony is that thinking about right action is not likely to succeed. Even if we do manage to figure out through thinking and analysis what the best action in a given situation is, we will typically be too late. So when we are lost in thinking, we are not present. We end up saying to ourselves, I should have said this, or I should have said that. And whether we come up with the appropriate response a second later, a minute later, or a day later, it is still too late. The moment has passed. Have you ever realized just a few seconds too late what to say, and then realized you had missed your chance, and then spent the rest of the conversation feeling excluded and out of sync? This is against the nature of fire, because the nature of fire is about actually embracing our oneness, is understanding the source of our true nature, and that this leads to a greater sense of connection. So, ironically, when we worry about appropriate behavior, we're less appropriate. Now, when we talk of fire, the principal organ is the heart, which is the monarch or emperor of the body-mind. The other organs are really just assistants to the emperor. And so when talking about fire, we are often talking about the heart. Another way of looking at the heart's role is to seek connection. Ultimately, this may be connection to God and remembering the time before we got a name, the time when we were still connected to the universe. But it starts with connection to self, and then connection to others. And this is where it has to begin, because it's an awfully big step from feeling disconnected to connected to all that there is. So fire then governs intimacy in our lives. Intimacy with ourselves and intimacy with others. Intimacy comes from the Latin word intimus, meaning inmost secret. Now, one half of intimacy is letting others in or being open, hence the phrase into me see as a translation of intimacy. But the other half is reaching out to others and being willing to touch them and see them. So intimacy is really about connection, and our restrictions to intimacy really come down to our deepest fears about ourselves. Really, what is it that we don't want anyone else to see about ourselves? This leads to a central theme of fire, acceptance. How can we let others into our inner world and our inmost sanctuary if we don't accept what is inside the gates of self? Since there is always imperfection, how can we accept ourselves? The answer to this question lies in awareness of essential connection into the Tao, or God. This, too, describes a paradox. The heart is the resonance of our Shen, or individual personality, and it is by virtue of the shining of this unique personality that we are able to observe the infinite variety of manifestation. But the heart and our fire element can only be in balance by keeping this individuality in perspective, by accepting ourselves as divine. As long as we are earthly beings, we struggle with accepting our personality as separate, while trying to accept ourselves as divine, and hence not separate. This struggle happens moment by moment, so the only central issue for fire is acceptance of the current moment, and then accepting our role in the current moment. And the glimpses of not being limited, and glimpses of not being just an individual, are always transient, and this is the nature of our existence. The purpose of the human is to actually have an earthly being and bridge heaven and earth, and not to live continuously in a state of expanded awareness that encompasses all that there is. The nature of having a human experience is having limitation of our perception, so that we can experience the full range of emotions. And so we have to be able to find those moments of joy by being present to each moment. If we're not present to each moment, then we miss opportunities for joy and for that sense of connection to the universe. The rhythm of fire is, of course, our heartbeat, and a regular heartbeat gives us stability and presence, literally because of the heart energy field being recreated with every heartbeat, then our awareness, and in a real way, our universe is recreated with each heartbeat. And so, two things. One, when our heartbeat is disturbed, we feel disturbed in ourselves, in our Shen, in our personality. But the converse is true. When our Shen or our personality is disturbed, then our heartbeat often becomes irregular, or we may get palpitations. The gift to remember about the heartbeat is that because our reality is actually recreated with each heartbeat, then there is actually in each new heartbeat, in each new moment, an opportunity for new perception and for joy. So let's talk about joy. The word joy refers to a great sense of happiness or delight or elation, usually attributed to some kind of success or breakthrough. In common usage, we associate the term joy with a euphoric state of being, although usually a transient state of being. Many spiritual books talk about joy in a different way, describing it as our natural state or inherent nature. This always makes me feel like I'm doing something wrong or that I'm living in the wrong place, because I don't always feel joy, and it doesn't look like the people around me are either. So these kinds of definitions are fairly useless, as they seem to imply you should be joyful even when you feel lousy. Many spiritual traditions talk about the joy of existence underlying all experience, and that's the joy that we should be connected to. So then, even in the midst of pain or sadness, we're grateful to be alive. This makes some intellectual sense, but if it's not your everyday experience, it just diminishes the importance of actual joy. If you're depressed, just having an intellectual appreciation of the idea that you should be happy you're alive doesn't change your reality. So let's talk about what causes joy. I think it is when you transcend yourself in some way. This can come from accomplishment when you have achieved something new. The first time a toddler manages to actually stand up and last for a few seconds before he tumbles over, there is sheer joy at having achieved something miraculous, or at least miraculous to someone who has only crawled up until that day. But once standing is routine, then the toddler pays no attention to this absolutely prodigious feat of neuromuscular coordination, instead concerning his or herself with walking, and then walking becomes routine, and we work on running, and then eventually on skipping and dancing, and so on. One way joy happens, then, is as a little reward for our continued growth. We don't always have to achieve something, however. We might have just lost ourselves in some activity that doesn't directly involve winning or achieving. This might be something active, like going for a walk in the forest or making love. It might be completely passive, like watching a beautiful sunset or watching your toddler take his first steps. But for the moment, we have forgotten ourselves and forgotten our limited self-perception. For a moment, connection to another person or connection to the world was more tangible and more powerful. Fire is like the sun. It is at its zenith only for a moment, and then we are in the afternoon, and the sun is waning. Noon really is just a moment when there's this maximum intensity of the fire, and that is the nature of fire. So the nature of joy is also transient. It is a glimpse. We need to have trust that another day, another noon, and another joy will come our way. And it is this trust that helps us let go of even a treasured experience like joy. This is hard because just the existence of joy contains the potential of its opposite, lack of joy or sadness. So our experience of joy actually lies on a continuum between elation and sadness. Depending on what is happening to us in any given moment, sadness may be the most appropriate response. If you've just suffered a loss, or if somebody close to you has just suffered a loss, being elated about the loss doesn't seem appropriate. The idea of laughing at somebody else's misfortune really doesn't seem appropriate. And a moment of compassion and empathy and sadness is dictated by the moment. Ideally, we experience joy and sadness as appropriate to that moment, and we don't attempt to linger in either state. True joy, then, is our reward for being in the moment, of being able to perceive something beautiful, something special, something magical happening in this moment, whether that's the beautiful sunset or a little child taking their first steps or an opportunity for actual connection with another human being. If that opportunity is seized, then there's joy. If it's not, then there's blandness and lack of joy, and that leads to sadness. The nature of propriety is right action. The highest expression of this virtue is to be fully present to each situation and each moment. This means being present to ourselves as well as present to others. This is being in the right place at the right time and doing the right thing. And to do that consistently is the virtue of propriety. This is harder than it sounds for many reasons. One is that if we identify with our separate personality, or Shen, we may think about what others will think about our words and actions, and hence hesitate while we're thinking. Since our personality is our identity, identifying with it is our default reaction. Really, identifying with who we are is the nature of the word. We identify with our identity. The other thing that gets in the way of being present is the desire to either hold on to past joy or to avoid sadness and sorrow. This leads to a need to control every situation, and then spontaneity and joy are lost. A couple of quotes that come to mind for me that I've always liked for capturing the essence of this easily. One is from Confucius, and it is, "How can one wish to hold for long the light of the setting sun?" This is obvious when we see it presented so clearly. The sunset is a moment, and then it's gone. And we can either enjoy it, but if we try to hold on to it, we can't actually hold on to it. Every attempt to hold on to it blinds us to fully being present to the beauty of the setting sun. A more modern writer, William Blake, said, "He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise." And I really like this one because it gives the idea that if we really just accept that this moment has joy and then release it and not try to actually hold on to it, the imagery of kissing the joy as it flies, so not even holding on to it for a moment, actually creates the spontaneity that opens us to more joy and to being more present, and so living in eternity's sunrise. And then the sunrise is, of course, the nature of fire. That is the reference, is that being in the moment is being in the sunlight all the time. The desire to avoid sorrow can also drive us into obsessive desire of more joy, which can lead to things like hedonism, the constant pursuit of pleasure, which paradoxically puts our awareness in the future instead of being present to the joy of the moment. That people who are really engaged with trying to achieve the maximum amount of pleasure or joy in life, there's a constant forward thinking. There's the, okay, now what's next? What am I going to do next to stimulate myself to experience some peak moment or some joy? And that constant need to worry about the next moment of joy actually takes you out of this moment. Another common reaction is to suppress joy or sadness, and this takes us out of the moment and precludes propriety. Ironically, by resisting strong emotion to seem appropriate, we become inappropriate and disconnected. Now, this doesn't sound like something we would want to do, is to suppress our joy, but I find it's quite common. One of the things that I've experienced in my own life, and I've seen, it's always easier to see things in other people, I've seen this in many people in my years of traveling around teaching energy medicine, and the idea that if we shift our thoughts and our perceptions, that we can shift the energy of the person we're working with, because that's essentially what we do in energy medicine, is we focus our observation and our intention on the idea that the other person's energy could shift. And when we actually surrender to that process, miracles happen. And that's exciting, and it's joyful. And nonetheless, often people who are interested in things like watching miracles and the joy of watching miracles are quite shy about telling other people. And then they're surprised that they can't build a business doing their healing work. And what a paradox that is, to be attracted to doing energy work, to do healing work, to be attracted to watching miracles, to be attracted to the joy of watching miracles, and then to feel too shy to share that with the world because you worry about what other people might think. Oh, they'll think I'm weird, or they'll think I'm bragging, or they'll think that I think I'm special. And nobody will think you're special if you're truly sincere and enthusiastic. They'll think you're excited. And nonetheless, I see it as one of the most common factors that prevents healers from being successful in practice. So suppressing joy or suppressing sadness, because many people try to hide their grief or hide their disappointment, and because they don't want others to feel like they're not strong, or they don't want to impose their feelings on other people. They don't want to be a downer. We all think we should be the life of the party or nothing, but we certainly shouldn't be depressed and tell other people that we're depressed. And so, ironically, when we suppress either emotion, then we've limited our opportunity to be connected to others, to actually share, to have some level of connection and intimacy. Since life is a give and take, if we are present, we know when we should be expanding and giving, and when we should be receiving. Someone with too much fire may dominate a conversation by talking all the time. This is expanding all the time, always trying to be the giver and not allowing contraction of their own energy to happen. So essentially not allowing the other person to get a word in. So this is not an equal conversation, and it's not actually creating a connection. So it's not creating joy for either party. On the other hand, just giving up and not participating in the conversation is also not being present. It's also not sharing of yourself. This means that the two primary distortions of joy, now this includes either reacting to our joy in a way that we suppress it, or being attached to our joy and thinking about our experience so much that we're not present, means that we either fall into control or apathy. We either try to control our situation so that we can control when we will get more joy, which ironically leads to less joy, or we give up being present. We're apathetic. We don't engage with life. And without engaging with life, we're not apt to experience much joy. Some other words to describe, then, the virtue of propriety are being insightful, being sagacious, and, you know, the idea of being like a sage who's always present to what's actually needed, being perceptive, being wise, having mastery, including mastering the art of non-doing. Often we try too hard and we do too much, and in our efforting, we end up avoiding being present and being joyful. And intimacy. Propriety actually leads to the ability to be intimate with those close to us, to be truly open and to be connected. It also gives confidence, and that's another word for propriety, is to not be in doubt and be hesitating in each situation. That cannot be propriety. Being confident in who you are and in your role, and then being able to be natural and spontaneous, that is true propriety. In Chinese, there's a word called wu wei, which means non-doing, and it's said that the highest ruler, the best emperor, rules by not doing. He rules through his very presence, not through actions. He engages with the world or empire with a minimal need to be intervening or to be changing the world. And this is the goal, is that when we stop worrying so much about being appropriate or being right, and we're fully present, just our presence can transform a situation. And when action is required, if we're not overthinking the action, if we're present, it'll come to us. We can be more intuitive and we can be more insightful when we're present. And the idea is that joy then relates to propriety, because joy is that reward for being present to the moment. Whether or not that's, yay, I just did something I've never ever done before, and to allow yourself to have that reward of joy, and or if it's to observe something that is just plain beautiful or stunning or exciting, and to be present to that moment and to not miss it. That experience of losing this sense of limitation is our reward for being present, and then in that presence, we can actually be more aware. It's a heightened state of awareness. And, you know, when we're guessing what the appropriate action is, what the other person needs to hear from us, then we're not really likely to say the right thing or do the right thing. Our chances improve when we're present and when we're spontaneous and when we're relaxed about who we are, when we've accepted ourselves. So propriety is really what comes out of acceptance. I want to say more about the nature of control. When we become attached to joy, or attached to avoiding sorrow, or attached to trying to stay off the roller coaster between joy and sadness, we fall into the trap of trying to control our lives. And that is an image that I find in working with people, is that sometimes because the either the dipping down into sadness is too painful, or the coming down from the peak of elation, of joy, is too disappointing. It's really, it's not remembering that the roller coaster will go back up again, and that that is the nature, that we can't stay frozen at the top. But if that experience of oscillating between joy and sadness, and that each moment contains a different level of joy, which gives us contrast, which gives us an appreciation for the joy, then there can be an attempt to create an even neutrality of evening out the hills and the valleys and trying to flatten life experience into something that contains perhaps neither great sadness, but certainly not great joy. And that leads to a ceaseless effort to control our lives. This is against our nature, however, because our nature is to reach for our destiny, but only our destiny can only be known in heaven. So our attempts to control our lives is not acknowledging the connection of our lives to the rest of existence. So it's really creating more separation from ourselves and from God. The idea of the phrase "let go and let God" is something many people strive to embrace, and yet it's much harder to do than we think. That when we feel we need to control every situation, we're basically not trusting that divine will make things work out. So the more controlled we are, then the more separate from our nature we are, the more separate from God we are, and the more separate from others. And it is in that each moment that we feel connection, that we feel joy. So when we try to control our lives, we eliminate the possibility of joy. The more we need to control every situation, essentially we are lying to ourselves about our nature and the nature of the world. So the nature of lying really lies in denying who we are. We're always lying to ourselves when we lie. And when we lie about ourselves to ourselves, we will lie about ourselves to others in an effort to hide our weaknesses and hide our insecurities. In essence, when we deny our nature, we are lying to everybody, including God. When the identification with one's shen is exaggerated, we are unwilling to show ourselves to the world, and we even become unwilling to show either our joy or our sadness. And so, in essence, if we are joyful, if we actually experience joy, to not express it, to not let it show on our faces, to not let it show on our words, is actually a lie. This need to control doesn't come from too much joy. Rather, it becomes a reaction to both joy and lack of joy. We can react to either the presence of joy by thinking, wow, I want that again. And then life becomes an effort to recreate that, rather than allowing it to create itself again in its own time. Or it could be a reaction to a painful event that produced sorrow or sadness, and that we at all cost want to avoid that. So it's not really the joy or the sadness that creates this need for control. It's our interpretation of the nature of joy and sadness, and it's our attempt to control it as a reaction. Now, some other words just to round out this concept of control is that this distortion of propriety is really a delusion about our true nature. It makes us defensive. It makes us protective. It makes us attached to experiences, but eventually attached to things. And so then we may seek joy in materialism and material possessions, because that's the only thing that seems to be tangible and continuous, because experiences come and go, and your fancy sports car seems to have continuity. And so that would be a safer way to achieve joy is to have something rather than allow life to happen. Involvement is another word that describes this resistance to just letting joy fly by. Domineering is another description of people with an imbalance in fire and an imbalance with experience in expressing joy. So they're trying to control situations, and part of that is dominating other people. So being domineering or overbearing or tyrannical or just plain bossy are all symptoms of being out of balance in the fire element and being in a reactive state to the transient nature of both joy. And really, that sadness should be a transient issue as well. That's something that we shouldn't linger any longer in sadness than we do in joy. And when we do, we call that depression. The distortion of apathy is, well, it's kind of the opposite of control. Now, true control is an illusion, and this is where the apathy starts from. And that's true, but this perception can be exaggerated. Just because you can't control everything in the universe doesn't really mean that you should take your hands off the steering wheel when you're driving a car. So you have to act like you're in control in life, even though you may at some level realize that there is a larger will than yours, that the will of the universe or the will of God is always going to take precedence over individual will, and that in sense that individual will is in some sense a delusion. So, but when this idea that, oh, there is no control becomes overemphasized, then you give up. You think your ability to manifest joy then is an illusion. So you give up expressing yourself, and you either acquiesce to the will of others, as you think that is the only possible source of joy. Oh, well, if I say yes all the time, then people will like me. And so the idea of having acceptance is then equated for joy, but it's not true acceptance because you haven't expressed who you are. You just went along with what other people thought. And so that's unsatisfying. And at some point you end up thinking, well, nobody likes me for who I am. They only like me for how I act or what I do. And so the apathy is actually it's an abdication of your responsibility of being you. And you try to deny that you have a unique personality. This is against our nature as well. This is a form of chaos, really, because you think there's no order or place in the universe for you, that your only choice is to be tossed around by circumstances and tossed around by the will of others, and that there's no real opportunity for you and your unique personality to engage with the world in a way that can provide authentic joy, the joy of being present and authentic. You may exhaust yourself in relentless hedonism as a way to fill this gap, but of not feeling like you can be in control. So since there really isn't any control, why have moderation? Why not just try to party as much as you can, and let's see if we can find an all-night party every night? So instead of trusting the universe to provide joy for you, you pursue it. And when the pursuit becomes desperate, you exhaust your chi, and hence your true connection to self and others, because you seek only joy rather than the richness of experience available to you in the world. So here's a few words about apathy, just to kind of round out the picture here, is that the lack of feeling like you can engage with the world, and hence being apathetic towards the world, is the same thing as having a chaotic perception of the world, that the world is chaos. It also leads people to be sycophants, people who just say yes all the time. It leads people to be submissive. It leads people to be meek or acquiescent. It can also lead us to being overly self-gratifying, overly self-indulgent, and hedonistic. It can also be making us dull and dreary. So it's somebody who walks into the room and doesn't really make an impact on it. You don't really notice them because they're not really showing up and interacting. And the idea is that sometimes when you interact, you won't always say the right thing, but you'll never say the right thing if you never say anything, if you never actually try, or if you never try to say something authentic. And so the virtue of propriety is to be in the right place at the right moment doing the right thing, and the disorder of it is to try to control every situation to make sure that the right thing is happening by having rigid rules about what should happen and how you should act, how others should act, and trying to control the situation. And this control keeps you from being present and keeps you from being spontaneous and keeps you from experiencing joy, because the joy only happens in the moment where something magical happened, and when we're efforting, we're not there. The other side of the equation is just not showing up to the party, of being in apathy. And if you're not present and you don't try to engage, you're also not going to have joy. Either way, the control or the apathy, they're still not being present. They're still ways of checking out from the responsibility of being present. You know, one is just simply checking out. That's the apathy. And the other is trying to plan everything, trying to control everything, trying to anticipate everything, which is a preoccupation with the future. Now, I'll talk briefly about the fire officials and the role that they play in the expression of joy and how they contribute to propriety. So the list of the officials is the heart, which, as I said, is the emperor, the pericardium, which is the ambassador or minister of the inner gate, the small intestine, which is the chief advisor to the emperor, and the triple heater, which is the minister of the outer frontier. Now, the heart is the emperor because it's the most important organ in the body, and the emperor is the most important person in the entire empire. And like the emperor, the heart rules or manages the whole rest of the body. And so each one of the officials in the emperor's court, each one of the organs in our metaphor, contributes something to the body and something to the mind. But the heart has the overreaching responsibility for managing everything and keeping it all under control. Now, classically, in terms of functions in Chinese medicine, the heart is said to govern blood, and this is because the heart actually produces blood, and it's said to house the mind, or the Shen. Now, this is actually part of governing the blood, is that having enough blood to actually house the mind, to actually allow the mind to be supported, is a principal theory of Chinese medicine. This sounds a little bit different, the idea that the house of the mind is actually the blood. This does make sense from a Western medicine point of view, because the blood is what actually supports neurological activity. And if we don't have sufficient blood to the brain, we don't have mental clarity. And so that's actually something that both Western and Eastern medicine agree on, that if you don't have enough blood and good quality blood with enough oxygen and enough oxygen carrying capacity and enough nutrients to reach the brain, your thinking isn't going to be terribly clear. So the idea of the heart being the governor of the blood and housing the mind is actually much saying the same thing. Now, another function of the heart in Chinese medicine is that it commands the qi. And the idea is that the heart pumps the chi around the body, and then the blood follows. Now, it's considered more the pumping of the chi that brings the blood than actually the physical pumping, which actually does have some support in modern research. But the key thing here is that the heart electrical field, the field that is generated by the electrical activity in the heart, actually encompasses the whole body, and it carries information. So this is the qi in Chinese medicine, and it is the idea that the heart actually communicates to the entire body through the qi. And, you know, in more Western terms, that is in one sense the electrical field generated by the heart with each and every heartbeat. The heart controls the tongue, and hence controls speech and laughter. And so a lot of being appropriate then is either saying the right thing at the right time or not saying the wrong thing at the right time. And there's also an appropriateness with laughter. So if something's funny, it's appropriate to laugh in the moment. An hour later, if you laugh without apparent reason, then that's inappropriate and people look at you funny. So, and to laugh at times when it's clearly not an appropriate time for laughter is also inappropriate. So one of the most obvious displays of appropriateness is our language and our laughter, and the heart rules both of those. It generates joy and sadness, and it's in charge of all the other organs and hence the whole mind. I said that. And it's really the most important organ to consider, the most important meridian to consider when talking about the nature of the fire element, the nature of joy, and the nature of the propriety, because it is primarily the heart which really generates the joy and generates the sadness. So the heart is considered the emperor because it supervises all the other organs and organizes their contributions to mind, and regulates the qi distribution to the whole body to coordinate all bodily activity. The knowledge of our nature that underlies true intimacy and the ability to connect lies in the heart. The other fire officials play the role of assistants to the emperor. Imbalances in the heart can produce irregular heartbeat or palpitations or chest tightness. Lack of fire, which corresponds to lack of energy in the heart, can also contribute to coldness, feelings of coldness in the body, and to sluggish digestion because there's not enough fire to warm the digestion and move it along. The next official is the pericardium, which is the envoy or ambassador of the heart. Now, this is not really an organ. It's the literal association with the pericardial sac around the heart is not the most appropriate translation. It's just the most common, which is why I use it here. The function is really just psychological. There aren't really any physical functions of the pericardium meridian, although there are some physical symptoms of imbalance. Its functions are really just the psychological ones. And this is to protect the heart and to express the joy of the heart. As I said, it's referred to as the minister of the inner gate or the ambassador of the heart. And in other translations, it's often called the heart protector, the heart master, or in some translations, the Shen protector or spirit protector, which I like that because, you know, when we think heart in English, we think of the physical heart first and the energetic or emotional heart usually second. But the idea of the spirit is that's our personality. That's protecting us, not just protecting our physical heart. And so spirit protector is actually the translation I like the best. The other term for it in some modern textbooks of applied kinesiology is circulation sex. And that's not a classical translation, but I mention it because it has some utility, because the applied kinesiology research has shown that this meridian actually rules many of the muscles of the pelvis and of the groin. And so, since the nature of fire is to actually seek intimacy, and one aspect of intimacy is sexual intimacy, then the one aspect of protecting the heart is actually to protect the genitals. And so there's a correspondence there that gives us some insight into the role of this meridian. It is to, you know, control who gets into our, literally, our innermost chambers. Now, one of the functions of the pericardium is to deflect blows aimed at the emperor. So, in that sense, to protect the emperor. And a lot of times we think just about that function when we hear the term Shen protector or spirit protector. But the term minister of the inner gate is actually maybe even a better term, because certainly not everybody in the empire gets to take up the emperor's time. And so the emperor is an important person and a valuable person, and you don't want just anybody marching into the emperor's chambers. So there needs to be both controls on who gets in the outer circle, and we'll get to the triple heater in a few minutes on that. But really, the last way of checking, the last control over who gets in, is the pericardium, the minister of the inner gate. And so some people should get in. It shouldn't be a completely locked door, because then you lock the emperor inside, and that's not appropriate. Which brings to mind the other role of the pericardium, is that when the heart or the emperor has something to say, there needs to be somebody to open the doors and express that out to the world. And so the pericardium is that meridian in the body, and the meridian itself goes right through the middle of the palm of our hands. And so the hand chakra in chakra theory is actually a pericardium point. So this ability to actually reach out and touch from the heart with other people, is a function of the pericardium. So it's not just about protecting. It has equally the function of allowing the joy of the heart to reach out and touch others. And it is through that touching and connecting to others that more joy can be generated, and it is actually joy that nurtures the fire element. It's common, however, for the heart protector or the pericardium to become over-involved or over-attached to the role of protection rather than in being the ambassador. And when the heart is protected, we really don't get life experience. We stand behind a wall, and we don't really deeply connect to other people. And that is usually an attempt to avoid hurt, but it actually precludes joy because it precludes connection. And so because people with a closed heart protector don't get enough life experience, they can often be quite immature. They can have naive and immature ideas about relationship and about life. There's a famous quote that everybody's heard from Alfred Lord Tennyson, which is, "'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all." And this captures the appropriate role of the pericardium, that it must exercise some caution in letting visitors into the emperor's chambers, but shouldn't lock the emperor in. Really, the question for the heart master or spirit protector is, who can I trust? And, you know, that might be a short list, but there needs to be a list. Otherwise, we're truly all alone. And this closing off the heart to protect future pain usually comes from some hurt in the past, some injury, some wound. And so it's an understandable reaction to try to close the door and not let anybody else get into the emperor's chambers and actually wound us in the heart. But unfortunately, that closure locks the pain inside, and it hasn't been dealt with. And the problem is that this becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy. When somebody shows up who seems promising and that you decide to open the gate and to take tentative steps towards relationship with this new person, if there's been pain locked in the Emperor's chambers by having an overprotected heart, then that first attempt to open the heart to a new person stirs up the pain and brings it to the surface. And then there's a confusion of the not being able to separate the joy of connection with this new person from the sadness and hurt and pain that's been stored from the previous painful relationship. And they all get jumbled up together, and it's very likely that the pain is then associated with the new individual. And so then the person is pushed away and the door is shut, and an additional pain is now locked inside the heart, making it even harder to trust the next time. The heart master or spirit protector then really has a strong role in our intimacy and our ability to let people into our heart. And because of that, it controls the muscles of the pelvis and circulation to the pelvis, and it really has a big role in controlling our sexuality. And so the logic is clear. If you wouldn't let somebody into your heart, well, then don't let them into your bedroom. But to actually experience connection at the deepest level, we need to be able to embrace intimate relationship and an intimate sexual relationship in our lives to really have fulfillment in the heart of deep connection to others. And so it again is this paradox of who we can trust. And if the pericardium is closed down too much, this can produce both over and under expressions of sexuality. It can literally shut down the physical response. And so in men that can be impotence, and in women frigidity, and in both the inability to actually achieve orgasm. It can also create a lack of interest or willingness to engage in relationships, or it can create a kind of hypersexuality to try to compensate for this sense of isolation in the heart. But it's then not a balanced sexuality. So a imbalance in the pericardium, which is shutting off true intimacy, can then manifest in either a overemphasis on sexuality, or even on perversion, which could either be trying to force intimacy on somebody else, or rather than having the actual intimate act be about connection and looking into each other's eyes, and the eyes are really the windows into the heart and the windows into the spirit, and so having true intimacy in a sexual relation is ideally about having that connection of the spirits within the heart. When that is absent because of too much restriction in the heart protector, there still may be a desire for sexual contact, but novelty and becomes more important, and so seeking stimulation in other ways because the true spiritual connection isn't available becomes important. Interestingly, this can also lead to a interest in pornography, in seeking sexual gratification without actual intimacy. Physically, imbalances in the pericardium can produce chest tightness and palpitations and nausea. The next official is the first yang official, which is the small intestine. Now, I said this is the advisor. The functions of the small intestine are to receive food and drink, to generate discernment, and assimilate useful knowledge to advise and protect the heart. So there is the physical aspect of receiving food and drink, but the small intestine is also charged with receiving knowledge about the world. It then separates the clear from the turbid and assimilates the useful nutrients and useful information and passes them inward. This helps the heart to be present to the world and to maintain propriety. Hence, the small intestine controls our ability to have clarity of mind, and hence to listen clearly and to speak our truth clearly. And this is the discernment, the separating the clear from the turbid. So just as some of the food we eat has valuable nutrients, and some of it is simply fiber, and some of it is actually toxic, that no matter how careful you are with your food, it's never absolutely pure, and there's always microorganisms and parasites that should be not assimilated or not absorbed. And the same thing with our information gathering from the world. There's useful information and there's not so useful information, and that needs to be clearly discerned. If it's not clearly discerned, then the heart doesn't have clear information. And so how can you be appropriate if you're not really aware of what's going on? And so in this sense is why the small intestine is like the advisor. It is charged with that intellectual aspect of wisdom, of separating the clear from the turbid and passing only the clear information on to the heart, and then being able to have the heart give insight and wisdom and to aid in the intellectual processing necessary to turn that back into words and into clear speech and into expressing our truth well. So in this way, the small intestine moves towards propriety. But when our relationship to joy is imbalanced and we move away from propriety, we feel like no one will hear us. And so this relates to that distortion of apathy. So that if we have a challenge with being heard, we may become apathetic and then decide that nobody can hear us. And when we shut down this pathway of information, then we are shutting down the heart's ability to be present and generate joy. So if we feel like nobody will hear us, why bother to reach out with our words? And the small intestine then is key for being able to listen for useful information. So avoidance of joy leads to an accumulation of negative experiences, and that is what we assimilate. And so that's the other part of how the small intestine plays a role in whether or not we experience joy or not. Again, it's not as directly related to actually generating the joy as the heart is, but it is a filter on our experience. Do we absorb the toxins and the parasites and pass that on as this is what the world has to offer, heart? And or do we manage to separate out the gems and the pearls of wisdom and the beautiful sunsets and the child taking its first steps and pass those miracles on to the heart? You know, where is the clarity of processing in the small intestine? And so it stores then patterns of either negativity or being receptive, that the idea of receiving is that each moment is a new opportunity to receive. And so just because you didn't like the last restaurant you went to doesn't mean you shouldn't have an open mind at this restaurant, because the food might be really good here. And just because the last experience you had in life or the last experience you had with this person was negative, well, the food might be better today. And so the small intestine plays a critical role in allowing us to stay open and present to receiving what's actually in front of us. Physically, imbalances in the small intestine lead to an inability to receive. So bloating and pressure and pain in the abdomen. And it can also lead to weakness, this imbalance in the small intestine, weakness and malnutrition because you're not absorbing well. Psychologically, when we continue to experience the world as negative and we continue to assimilate and absorb negative experiences into our being, and that becomes an expectation, this leads to bitterness, and it also leads to depression. And it also leads to sarcasm. And so the overuse of sarcasm actually reflects an inability to receive in the moment. It reflects a predisposition to prejudge experience as negative and to hence label it and judge it so. The next minister is the Triple Heater, and this is the Minister of the Outer Gate. Now, the functions in Chinese medicine of the Triple Heater are to govern the water passages, coordinate the digestion, it helps to govern the Wei Qi, it regulates our boundaries with the world, and it's the Minister of the Outer Frontier. Also, sometimes referred to as the Minister of Irrigation because it does control the water passages in the body. So the ability of water to move freely in the body and not get stuck is a Triple Heater function. The one that's most important out of that here for us is, in some sense, the governing the Wei Qi, because one of the roles of the Triple Heater is to maintain connection with the outer world to help regulate our inner world. And so it's related to the Heart Master in the sense of governing this sense of boundaries. Who gets in? Who can we trust? That's a common theme between the two meridians. But whereas the pericardium is that minister of the inner gate and hence charged with decisions about who gets into the innermost chamber, and the Heart Master is really about truly intimate relationships of close friends and sexual partners. But the Triple Heater then is involved with our larger circle of friends and even acquaintances. And so not just even friendships, but acquaintanceships. So it's more about social connections rather than those deeply intimate connections. So it's still a question of who we should trust, but it should be a much larger list for who you can be friends with or who you can be friendly with and be acquaintances with than those people who are in your inner circle. And in that sense, the idea of governing our boundaries is then a key role of the Triple Heater. Now, the coordinating digestion is because the Triple Heater gets its name. Again, there is no organ called the Triple Heater, it's just a meridian, because there's three areas of activity in the body, and activity generates heat or warmth. So you have the upper heater is above the diaphragm, the middle heater is the upper organs of digestion, and then the lower heater is the lower abdomen and the organs of elimination. So having all those work together is essential for digestion, but as I just talked about with the small intestine, part of digestion is actually absorbing nutrients from the world, and part of digestion is absorbing useful information from the world. And so there's a synergy between the Triple Heater and the small intestine in that role of gathering and processing useful information. So kind of overlaps both with the small intestine and with the heart protector or pericardium meridian. Now, the Triple Heater responds to pain in the heart by either being over-open or over-closed. So the over-closed is probably easier to understand, of like, right, I'll just be overly restrictive. And this can be somebody who's dogmatic in their opinions, and that can be somebody who's religiously dogmatic or just dogmatic in their political views or in any other aspect of life. But it essentially is, if you don't believe as I believe, you can't be my friend. And so it's rigid and judgmental rules, and it can be judgmental about friendships. Somebody with a Triple Heater imbalance breaks off friendships, even long-term relationships, too easily, because as soon as you break a rule, you're out. And so it's a protection of the heart manifesting out on the exterior of the person, because this protectionism is so rigid that you feel like you really need to keep people out of the country, let alone the emperor's chambers, basically, unless they pass all the tests, tick all the boxes. But the other one is a little bit harder to understand, is the idea that of being overly open. So, and this is understandable, though, from the idea that is, if there's nobody in this empire, in this country, in my circle of friends, who's actually acceptable, I must just know all the wrong people. So I'll reach out desperately to try to make more and more contact. And so this is trying to expand the boundaries of the empire to incorporate new people, because you're not really very happy with the people that are there. And so that's the idea of trying to push out and get new friends rather than figure out how to be friends with the people in your life. Let's just go get new ones, basically. So, all right. So physically, the triple heater imbalance can lead to earaches, deafness, and neuralgia on the side of the head, and elbow and shoulder pain, as well as temperature dysregulation. So if you're too hot or too cold a lot of the time, that can be a triple heater imbalance. Okay, I'll close with a few thoughts about the summarizing the nature of joy, sadness, and propriety. And then I'll go through a few belief systems to think about that may be keeping you from being more spontaneous and more present to joy and sadness. So that'll be discussed in the homework as well. Now, when we open ourselves up to joy and sadness, we allow ourselves to be present. And when we allow ourselves to be present, we can be in propriety. That's the overall message of the fire element, is to strive for this virtue of propriety, which ironically means not striving. So joy is our reward for being present to opportunities to transcend our sense of limits and barriers and to connect to ourselves and others more intimately and more genuinely. And this includes both the taking a chance of achieving something new, of trying something new and actually achieving it, as well as just simply being present to the accomplishments and experiences of others and deriving joy from observation. The risk of being present is that you may experience pain or sadness more deeply. In fact, you will, because painful things will happen, and you will experience sadness. And if we're fully present, that sadness will be more intense. But that's the price of joy. The price of joy is actually being willing to be present, and sometimes being present is going to be painful, and sometimes it'll be sad. The more times we are rewarded for being present, and again, I think of joy as that reward for being present, the only way you're going to actually experience it by being present, well, the easier it becomes, and the less afraid we become of being wounded, and hence the more open to joy we become. Experience, especially early life experiences, can lead to a misperception of the world and of our nature that makes us resistant to being present. And these beliefs or these perceptions keep us from experiencing joy and sadness, and keep us really stuck in the past and or worried about the future, trying to prevent future pain or future sadness, or to hold on to past joy as a compensation for not being present now. So here's some beliefs that can keep us present to can keep us from being present to opportunities from joy. I'm not lovable, which is another way of saying I'm not acceptable. I don't deserve joy, which is not that different than I'm not acceptable, but it's a different phrasing of that. I have to be responsible. This is a common one, that we think we need to be responsible or grown up or something like that keeps us from being present. So even if the present looks inviting, that it might even afford an opportunity for joy, I have to get things done, I have to be the grown up, I have to be responsible. Or it may be simply a belief that I don't get to be joyful, or I don't get to be happy. It's a misperception of self as being somehow not worthy. And that, of course, derives from not being connected to the universe. So you couldn't possibly think you don't get to be joyful or happy or you're not lovable or acceptable unless you thought that you weren't actually divine or connected to all that there is. Here's another thing that revolves around the idea of protection, is better safe than sorry. So rather than I mean, in some things that's a good idea, but if it makes you close down to relationship because you'd rather be safe and then get hurt, well, then that's being closed down to the present. I have to protect myself contains within it the idea that that's the nature of life, is being wounded, so you better shut off from life. I'm not safe is another idea of saying this, or intimacy is not safe. If we've experienced pain in the past, we could think, I'll never be happy again. And so we'll live our lives then shut down to even being possible to be happy, because we just don't believe it's possible. Once bitten, twice shy is another saying that comes to mind, and that people may embrace as a life strategy. And although, you know, when somebody has wronged you, it makes sense to remember that to some degree, is to don't keep making the same mistakes with the same person over and over. There is a valid aspect of deciding who to trust. But if that can turn into, oh, I've been bitten before by someone, and now I won't trust anyone. And so this is an over-embracing of this idea, once bitten, twice shy. Or simply, I'll never be good enough, is maybe the experience of somebody who never found approval for who they are in early life, and enters their life with doubt rather than confidence, and never has a try at actually expressing themselves. There's some exercises in the homework to help you look at and process these belief systems, and thank you for your time, and join me for the next lecture on the earth element.